Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court is now in session. The Honorable Justice Rebecca Russell Bradley presiding. Court silence is commanded.
Good morning, everyone. You may be seated. Welcome, everyone, to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. I understand we have a class joining us, Madison Community Montessori School. Are you here?
No.
Usually Montessori.
All right.
My grandchildren go to Montessori School, and I don't see that age group here.
It's on my list.
Yeah, okay.
Waupun High School? Okay, would you all please rise so we can give you a proper welcome? Wonderful to see you all. And are you able to stay for court with class? Wonderful. I'm looking in the wrong direction because she usually sits over here. Justice Janet Protasiewicz will be meeting with you after oral argument, not to discuss the case, but to discuss what the court does and answer any questions that you might have for her. It's your chance to ask a justice. Well, anything. Can't promise she'll answer it all, though. All right, you may be seated. Welcome again. All right. With that, we are here to hear argument in the case of Moreway versus Moreway. Mr. O'Neill?
Good morning, Justices. My name is Matt O'Neill. I represent the petitioner, David Moreway, and may it please the court. There are three fundamental truths that should guide this appeal. The first is that parties in Wisconsin have a right to try their case to a trial court, and the party that is unsuccessful on any issue has the right to appeal that issue. Second is that an appeal in Wisconsin should involve all of the issues that were litigated between the parties in one appeal. And third is that the appeal in this case should include all of the issues, all of the matters in litigation that were before Judge Williams. And that includes the judge's decision on the motion to modify maintenance, the judge's decision awarding fees relating to an earlier motion to compel, and the judge's decision finding that there was some overtrial regarding three discrete issues. All three of those decisions resolve matters that were in litigation between the same parties on the same dispute on the same record. Section 808.03 guides the court's decision regarding what is a final order for appeal, and the language is straightforward. A final order is one that disposes of the entire matter in litigation as to one or more of the parties.
Mr. O'Neill, so there was no motion for overtrial in front of Judge Williams at the time, correct? There was a statement made that that was forthcoming.
No. If I can clarify, Your Honor, after the trial, the judge asked for post-trial briefing. In the post-trial briefing, Karen's counsel explicitly requested fees for overtrial. That issue was then briefed. I filed a response brief on the issue, and it was argued during the initial argument after the trial court's decision. And what the trial court held is, I don't find any overtrial occurred during the trial of this matter. It was efficient. There was no overtrial.
Okay, all right. So we're talking about two. We're talking past each other. And that's, thank you for clarifying that. I'm not talking about the overtrial, about the trial. The specific issue that's in front of us today is regarding overtrial with respect to discovery violations, correct?
Correct.
So that was not resolved by Judge Williams.
It was not resolved, but the issue was raised prior to that initial May 24th order. That was the issue that was raised in the post-trial brief by Karen's counsel, was overtrial throughout the matter. And what happened at oral argument is the court said, I didn't see any overtrial in the trial that was tried to me. And Karen's counsel said to the court judge, there was overtrial throughout this matter, happened during discovery, happened here, and the judge said, wait, that's not in the briefing, that's not in front of
me. Okay, so the judge said, that's not in front of me. And the upshot was that the judge said, bring it, bring a motion.
Yes.
And the attorney said they were going to bring a motion.
Yes.
Now, let me just say to you, what if they never brought a motion?
If
what if it's, we're talking like months later, and the motion never came? Who gets, how do you know when the case is final under your theory of this?
Right. What would have happened if Attorney Anse did not file the motion she promised to file and in effect was ordered to file? As I would have called and said, are you going to file that motion? And if I got a no answer, I would have filed a proposed order that was a final order disposing of everything. And, Your Honor, there was still one more matter that was in the air, and we were headed back to Judge.
Before you go to that matter, Mr. O'Neill, I just want to go back and just put a final point on the conversation you're having with Justice Gallet, because I'm looking at the transcript. It's page 25 of 76 or 22 of 29. I don't know why there are so many different page numbers on these transcripts, but I'm going to wait for you to get to where you think I am. It's where the judge is at the very end. It was right at the point that you were talking about, and she does say, that's not in front of me. But then if you go down about four lines, Mr. Anse says, I'll file a separate motion. The court says, all right. Ms. Anse says, I understand. And then the court says this, based on your request now, I am denying it because there wasn't anything that I can consider for that, and it's not fair. So it seems to me that at that moment in time, the motion had been denied. It was dead until someone brought it back, right? So even if it was in front of the judge at that time, which I think is part of your argument, the judge says, no, I'm not, you know what? I don't have enough in front of me based on the request as it stands right now. I'm going to deny it. Done.
That's correct. That was when the judge interpreted the request as being with respect to overtrial during the trial. That's what she denied. But the prior colloquy said, if you saying that this relates to things that happened prior to trial, you need to lay that out for me. And Attorney Anse said, I will. And in the order that subsequently followed, it was clear that was going to happen. Now, going back to the question of what would have happened, another thing that was left open in the May 24th order was the calculation of fees regarding the motion to compel that it happened before the family court commissioner. That issue was then, there was an affidavit submitted with the briefs. We responded to it, objected to it, and we then went back in front of the judge for a hearing on that and got a decision. Had there been no motion for overtrial filed, as was promised, at that point, we could have had that order be the final order in the case.
Okay, but in another case, the scenario that you're giving us is one by which it would be the person, your client, is the one who gets to determine when there's finality, essentially. By your phone call, that's when finality is determined, because then you're going to ask for the order of the court. And so that finality point that is also, you talked about the principles of appeal and some of the things that we find important. One of them is finality. And the way that you're describing this really leaves in the air as to when there's finality about a motion that someone says they're going to file that they haven't actually filed yet. And you're saying, well, it would happen when we'd say, well, have you filed it? What if they said, well, I need another 3 weeks, I need another 6 weeks, I need another 2 months? How do we, when we leave it up to people saying they're going to do something as opposed to what they've actually done, doesn't that cause a lot of uncertainty with respect to finality?
I don't think it does, Your Honor. I think the opposite is true, that if you allow parties who have ongoing issues, matters in litigation, all these matters in litigation related to the same trial before the family court commissioner, the same proceedings. And if a party can say, as they did here, I'm going to file this motion, Your Honor, it's all teed up, I've even argued it before you, and then just hold off until they do that to try to make what otherwise is a non-final order final, that's the problem for practitioners. From the perspective of Mr. Morway, this was a seamless continuation of litigation after the trial before the judge, post-trial briefing, argument, the dispute about overtrial, Attorney Anse saying, I'm going to file the motion. Motion's filed 9 days after the order. It's litigated. There was no break in the proceedings. We were continuing to argue about the matters in litigation. And when the final order came in, which is the one that resolved the overtrial issue, all matters in litigation had been disposed of, and the appeal commenced.
Attorney O'Neill, I've got a question or two for you. First of all, I'm looking at the order that Judge Williams signed on May 24th of 2023, a lengthy order I think we would all agree. My question to you is, can you point me to any part in this order where the court leaves anything related specifically to maintenance as unresolved?
As to maintenance, the only thing that was unresolved was the number of days that would apply to when Mr. Morroway was going to pay things and how the $671.54 was going to be applied. There were a couple of blanks in there, and the parties then, we convened after and got that worked out by stipulation. But as to the overall motion where we were asking for maintenance to be modified, that issue was addressed and resolved. The remaining issue, the unresolved issue, had to do with the overtrial and then the calculation of the fees for the motion to compel.
Well, I'm just wondering, and I understand that this is a Court of Appeals case, Campbell v. Campbell from 2002. Are you able to distinguish Campbell, help us out here, with the facts at bar today?
I am. In Campbell versus Campbell, this was a child support and arrearages case, and there were actually three orders entered in that case. The first case established what the child support was going to be. And then the court said, we're going to need to do an audit and determine the amount of arrearages. And so that process somehow took, I think, up to 10 months. And then there was a second order that was entered saying, here's the amount of arrearages that you have to pay. There was unresolved at that point a request for attorney's fees to be assessed under the statute that allows a family court judge to assess fees based on need. And what the Court of Appeals held is that the original order that established the amount of child support and said this is what you have to pay and this is what you haven't paid was not final because the calculation of arrearages needed to be done before that issue to be resolved. So that second order was the final order, and the court said under the line of cases starting from the ACLU case through Leskey, through Laub, that said where there's a statutory fee shift, if that's the only issue remaining, all other substantive issues resolved at the that pending motion does not make the order non-final. So it still is final if that's pending. And so what Campbell said is, yeah, that's similar to these other cases. So the fact that there was a motion for fees under the statute, the order was final. It didn't make it not final. Here, what was promised and litigated was not a fee shift under a statute. It was not a fee shift under any of the statutes. This is over trial. Substantive issue. Both parties on this appeal agree it doesn't fall under those exceptions under Campbell, under Leskey, under ACLU. We all agree that that's not the case. And the Karen's counsel, respondent's counsel, they concede if a motion for overtrial had been filed before the May 24th order was entered, they agree that May 24th order was not final.
Counsel, if you have a decision that is appealed from, I'm just curious, from a logistical standpoint and just even what our rules say on this, which I'm not sure of, what remains, what motions could you continue to file in the circuit court? So what I'm trying to get at here is, so suppose the maintenance, you know, issue is resolved and every, you know, and then that's appealed from. Could you go back to the circuit court and file a motion for others, you know, related to sanctions like overtrial or opposing counsel? Or once that notice of appeal comes from, is your ability to deal with issues, the circuit court's ability to deal with issues, kind of extinguished until the appeal's resolved?
I don't have the statute in front of me, but there's a specific statute. I think it's 80607, but I apologize. I don't know it specifically. It says after an appeal is filed, the circuit court's jurisdiction is limited to certain things. One of those things is costs, so you can always deal with the cost motion and calculating the costs. 80607 allows parties to come back and seek supplemental relief. I think it's 80607-1H is the catch-all that allows you to go back and ask for other things. And those motions, I believe, don't make the final order non-final. Mm-hmm. But here, I come back to 80803 says all matters in litigation have been resolved, and they weren't. The overtrial was a matter in litigation. It was seamless. There wasn't a question that this was going to be ongoing litigation between the same two parties before the same judge on the same record. And really, for clarity of practice, The court should establish in a circumstance like that, you wait until the actual final order so all of those issues can be on one appeal. Because what otherwise would happen, I would have had to file an appeal, a notice of appeal from the May 24th order, perhaps have to file a separate appeal from the June 23rd order that set the amount on the sanctions, and then file a third appeal from the August 28, 2024 decision that established the overtrial fees.
Two quick follow-ups on your broader, you know, arguments about the sort of systemic issues and maybe need for greater clarity. From your perspective, how big of a problem is this, really, of lack of clarity about whether an order is final or not? And I'm curious if it's particularly relevant in family law cases, which, you know, much less likely to make their way through the appellate system, to at least here. But even when I was in the Court of Appeals, we didn't get a ton of them. And so how big of a problem is it? And then number two, do you think that are addressing some of these matters as we have in the past, just through our superintending authority, trying to clarify things in prior cases, was the right approach? Or would rulemaking be another way to have stakeholders or others weigh into, you know, addressing these to make sure we, because my worry is I don't know what I don't know on some of these questions. So both of these go to that. So curious as your answers to both of those.
In my experience, Your Honor, it has not been a complicated issue because in my practice, I can't recall another case where Wambolt was disregarded. So this court in 2007 instructing all parties that a final order needs to say it's final for purposes of appeal. What happens in most courts that I practice in, the judges ask the parties to draft the order, and when it's final, you put in finality. Particularly if you're the successful party, you want to put that in. I've had situations where somebody puts in an order that this is final for purposes of appeal, and the other side writes a letter and submits an order, says it's not because of X, Y, and Z. Then you have a hearing, and the judge decides whether to include that language or not include that language. So what my experience with Wambolt is that it has been a boon to the practice. I go back and practice where I practiced with this gentleman, Bob Friebert, and he was great and my mentor for years and years. And Bob would appeal from everything. No matter what the order was, he would appeal because back then there was no rule like this. And so we'd end up with four different appeals. We'd consolidate, do all this stuff. And you no longer have to do that because Wambolt brings and brought clarity to the issue. And here, as it's pointed out in the record, the order, the May 24th order, was drafted by the same counsel that said, I'm going to bring that motion for overtrial. The order that was drafted said the counsel will file a motion for overtrial. So there was no dispute that was going to happen, and that order didn't say it was final for purposes of appeal. I submitted my own proposed order. It didn't say it was final for purposes of appeal because I was certain it wasn't. I knew there were still active matters in litigation, and I gave conscious thought to it. I looked into it and determined that was not a final order because we still had matters in litigation, which we litigated out, and then I filed my appeal a couple days after we got the final decision. There was one, it was a comment in their brief that none of the three orders in the case have that finality. And I will say this, the final decision that came out just came out from Judge Williams. She didn't ask for a proposed order, so the parties didn't have a chance to submit it. But had there been a request for proposed orders, I think both sides would have said, this is a final order for purposes of appeal.
I just want to say I'm slightly surprised by your answer because I thought you were going to say this is a problem and this is why at the end of my brief I propose this new approach that you should say it's either final or it isn't final. And so I think I have just two comments. I'm going to ask you to respond to them. I'm sorry I cut you off. So maybe you can go back to that too. But my first comment is I'm surprised that you're not telling us that this is a bigger problem than it is if it's just in this case, or maybe you're going to tell me you've had it in a handful of other cases. The second thing is, if we did what you're asking us to do and we change the rule and we, as far as final orders are concerned, and we say you either have to say it's a final or a non-final order, I don't see how we get around what the author in Wambolt very deftly wrote in paragraph 4. I'm smiling to Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. But she wrote in paragraph 4, I think she had to thread a needle here, and I think you would continue to have to thread this needle to a certain extent. And it says, we will, commencing September 1st, 2007,
require a statement on the face of a document that it is final for the purposes of appeal, period. Could have ended there, but it doesn't, right? She has to go on, and she says, absent such a statement, appellate court should liberally construe ambiguities to preserve the right of an appeal. And I think you're somewhat, I was a busy circuit court judge, Justice Dallow was on the circuit court, both Justice Bradley's and Justice Protasiewicz, sorry, Justice Hagedorn, he did good work on the court. it's busy, right? And you're doing the best you can, and you're trying to catch everything that you can, and sometimes these things don't happen. And so even with your suggestion, it's still, there might be a busy circuit court judge, it could have been me, who forgets to do that, and you're still going to have to go to then what happens next.
So, Your Honor, I never look at a problem and say, if I can't solve it completely, I'm not going to solve it some more. And what I think the rule would benefit from, the Womble rule, is that second point, which is, and I'm not talking about every order in a case. I'm saying after a decision on a dispositive issue, after a trial, any order at the end of proceedings requiring the circuit court to say this is a final order or this is not a final order would make the Womble rule, which I think has been primarily effective, even more effective. And Womble requires the circuit court to make that determination. If you're telling the court you have to say that a final order is final, that means the circuit court has to consider, is this final? And all expanding the rule would do is make that decision process explicit in either case. This is not a final order. This is a final order.
Attorney O'Neill, does it make any difference that this is a post-judgment matter?
It doesn't. I think it is still litigation between two parties, and the question is, when are all matters in litigation between the parties disposed of? So I don't think there's a different analysis. And where the court addresses this in Womble and in Tyler is it says whether the case is dismissed or the matter's adjudged. So on a post-trial issue, the matters are adjudged because the underlying case has previously been dismissed.
So you're saying what matters is whether or not all of the issues have been disposed of. One approach is to take a look at the motion filed, see that as setting up the framework where you need then the final document, order, or judgment, to reflect whether or not it's disposed of those matters that are raised in the motion. You know, kind of a reverse mirror, or rather a mirror image. But you're saying in your answer, all matters, even matters that were not raised initially in the motion. Is that your position?
It is, and it happens all the time that when somebody starts a proceeding with a complaint, a post-verdict or post-trial thing with a motion, that other matters are added to the litigation. Counterclaims are added, other claims are added, motions are added. And the notion of 808.03 is all those should be part of one appeal, not two appeals, not three appeals.
I was not clear as to what the focus of your argument is with regard to the first issue. The issue number one is, as stated in your brief, where there is no finality language, as required in Womble, and expressly contemplates additional substantive litigation between the parties. A final order under the statute for final for purposes of appeal. Do you consider the issue of attorney's fees for a motion to compel substantive?
I consider the motion to compel to be substantive. It is a substantive matter in that proceeding that needs to be and should be resolved before all issues have been disposed of. It's not a self-answering question about whether the simple calculation of how much fees after the determination has been made that there is fees due, whether that would be final. It's clear from the ACLU line of cases that somebody wins a 1983 case, they're entitled to attorney's fees under 1988. That is a separate issue that does not deprive the decision on the 1983 of finality. But the question about whether just attorney's fees in general make it not final I think only under the existing case law, that's the case where there is a statutory fee shift at issue. Those are the, that's the whole line of cases where there's a statute that says there's a fee shift.
Then if you consider, and I wasn't sure what your answer would be, certainly both parties are acknowledging or are advancing that overtrial is substantive.
Yes.
As I read the briefs. But I'm not sure about this motion to compel attorney's fees, but you consider that to be substantive also. The reason I asked in part was your focus seems to be on this overtrial issue rather than number 6 in the order that was signed on May 24th. Number 6 in the order signed on May 24th indicates that the motion to compel attorney's fees, although there's entitlement to attorney's fees, the amount will be determined. You have to be filing it. So this is explicitly left open.
Correct. And
but you seem to be focusing the argument more on paragraph 17, which deals with the language, and Karen will file a separate motion on this issue. So that's, you don't seem to be arguing so much regarding number 6. Am I missing that argument?
Not missing. And, Your Honor, perhaps I was misled by the analysis by the Court of Appeals by which my appeal was suddenly cut by the biggest third of the thirds. But I do agree that the motion to compel, because it was brought during the proceedings, is a part of the substantive matters in litigation between the parties. And what was resolved prior to May 24th was that there was going to be an award. What was not resolved was how much that award was going to be. And if you applied the analysis in Campbell regarding establishing that there what the child support was but needing to calculate the arrearages and that second order being final, then the answer would be that the final order in this case was the June 23rd, 2023 order that established the amount of the fees on the motion to compel. In which case, my appeal was timely.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Brad?
Mr. O'Neill, I don't think that cite to 80607 was correct, so maybe when you come, you have the statute books in front of you.
Ooh.
I couldn't have done it on the fly either, but if you could, maybe when you come back up, tell us what that statute is, that'd be very helpful to me.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Lyons?
Good morning, Justices. My name is Greg Lyons of O'Neill Cannon, and I represent Karen Morway. Also at council table is an attorney for my firm, Ryan Reby. May it please the court. I will address two issues this morning. First, why the May 24th order was final, and therefore David's appeal was untimely and deprived the Court of Appeals of subject matter jurisdiction. The second issue I will address will be the finality statement as required by Wambolt and Tyler and some other cases. On the issue of timeliness of this appeal, the Court of Appeals got this right. On May 24th, 2023, after a three-day evidentiary hearing, post-trial briefing, separate oral ruling, and the Circuit Court entered a written order denying David of his motion in its entirety and thereby resolving all matters pending before the court. In our case, the Circuit Court fully resolved David's motion. First, it ruled that it would not terminate or hold open maintenance. And second, then it modified maintenance. At that point, and this isn't in dispute, there was nothing left for the court to do. 100% of the relief sought by David's motion was addressed.
And why wasn't that? Go ahead.
I was just going to say, how do you respond to Mr. O'Neill's argument that I'm looking at the order, I'm looking at number 17, that last sentence says Karen will file a separate motion on this issue, on that issue means that contribution to attorney's fees for overtrial. So how do you respond to his point that clearly there was still a separate motion left hanging out there that needed to be attended to by the court?
Sure thing. If you look at the actual order, well, first of all, backing up before the order was entered, back at the oral argument, and I think, Justice, you brought this up, there was discussion about the motion for overtrial. And in that hearing, the circuit court wanted to know about the discovery motion and also the discovery of the overtrial issue. And the court said, and I quote, "This is new to me, hearing you say that we had to take depositions because a theory was abandoned. That's not in front of me. I didn't hear anything about that." The court then goes on to say, "Based on your request now, I'm denying it because there wasn't anything that I can consider for that, and it's not fair." The circuit court was clear that—
Counsel, I'm going to ask you to point me specifically to the portions of the May 24th order that make it clear that it was final for purposes of appeal.
There isn't a direct reference or finding on the actual order itself. However, the order itself does adjudge the entire motion that was brought before it by David.
Then why not include the finality statement?
Well, obviously, it could have been included. It wasn't included. But this court has ruled, and other courts have ruled, that the lack of a finality statement doesn't make an order ambiguous, and nor does it make a final order non-final.
So we're just supposed to ignore Wambolt, written by my esteemed colleague to my right, which says it must be included?
We are not supposed to ignore it, but in this case it was ignored on all three orders, that it didn't exist in any of them. But like I say, this court has said that that doesn't affect the issue of subject matter jurisdiction before the Court of Appeals.
Well, I guess what you're saying then is that he's getting to appeal two of the issues without that language that should have been required, correct?
Sure. Had David filed a motion 10 days earlier, he would have been able to obtain an appeal of all three different orders.
Your friend on the other side, I believe in briefing, has characterized this situation as a and switch, and it does feel that way when we read the order, when we read the transcript. The court's order says Karen will file a separate motion on the issue of overtrial, which you have conceded is a substantive issue, which led counsel on the other side to believe that all matters were not concluded. In fact, the motion was filed just 9 days later. So now to argue that the May 24th order was final, even though there was a pending motion contemplated, don't you think that that misled counsel into believing he would have more time to file an appeal on behalf of his client?
I don't think so, Your Honor, and I don't think there was any bait and switch, and there certainly wasn't anything intended. Counsel's giving me way too much credit in terms of trying to do this. I assure you that there was no intention whatsoever. After the May 24th order, counsel had 90 days, like any other litigant, to appeal the matter. And if he was getting close to that 90 days and there were things that he wasn't sure about, he certainly could have filed a protective appeal. As to the order itself, if you think about it, when you look at the order, it's an 8-page decision, and it mostly consists of findings. And paragraph 17 is the finding where the order says that Karen will file a separate motion. That is simply a recitation of what Karen had said during the transcript. That is not an order. Counsel says in his brief, and said it this morning, that it is effectively an order by the court that she will file a motion for overtrial. If you notice, there are 6 orders that follow the findings. There is not a 7th order that says Karen will file a motion for overtrial. And in fact, no authority has been presented to this court that a circuit court would have the authority, have the power, to order a litigant to bring a motion that would benefit that litigant.
Counsel, I just want to sort of zero down on how you're doing some line drawing here. So if the motion for overtrial had been filed on May 23rd, but the language of the order was substantially identical, well, I'll just say if it had been filed May 23rd, do you think that that would have been final for purposes of appeal?
If it was pending at the time, the key is whether or not it's pending. Was there anything for the trial court to do? What we know is on May 24th, There was nothing left for the circuit court to do. There was no substantive issue that remained.
Okay.
Had it been pending at the time, which is a hypothetical that doesn't exist here, but had it been pending, that would be a different analysis.
Well, that raises an interesting question for me, because some of your briefings suggest that because this was a motion for, you know, maintenance modification, and because it deals with maintenance modification and answers all that question, therefore it becomes final for purposes of appeal. But it sounds like you are saying that's not necessarily the case if there are other motions like overtrial that had been pending at the time. Even if the maintenance issues are resolved, you're conceding that overtrial itself as a separate issue would make it non-final if it had been pending. Is that right?
I believe that's the case. It is a substantive motion, and we're not running from that. We think that is. Now, whether or not if it's a substantive motion does not necessarily mean it falls outside of the Lesby and Campbell exception.
Fair enough. So, why is the line whether it has been filed or not? If the parties agree that further litigation is forthcoming, but they just haven't filed the briefs or made the motion yet, but there's at least acknowledgement here in the order that it's coming, why is that not enough? If you agree that a motion for overtrial itself would make this a live, non-final case, why does the fact that it wasn't filed yet make a difference? I don't understand why that would be the line.
Well, mainly because this court has said that what happens in the future can affect finality. So in other words, the court has to look at the order at the time it was entered. That's what the cases have said. So if you look at the time when the case has been entered, if it's not pending, then it's not before the court. There is nothing that left that remains, which is what Tyler says. If you have substantive issues and something substantive remains, you don't have a final order. That's not what we had here. On May 24th, 2023, it's not in dispute. There was absolutely nothing for the trial court to do. And if had David filed a notice of appeal on May 25th, the day after, that would have been accepted and that would have been fine.
So if you would have agreed and he would have agreed, the judge would have acknowledged that a motion was coming on May 25th, sounds like your position is still that the May 24th order was final for purposes of appeal because it was not pending on May 24th.
The key is whether or not at the time the order is entered. At that time, what is left for the circuit court to do? And it has to be that way.
But there are like further, your opposing counsel made this point, I think it's right, that there are always issues that linger that are additional issues that are. Again, just explain to me one more time, and then I'll let my other colleagues ask questions here. I apologize. But why the fact that a motion is pending answers the question of whether all of the issues in the litigation have been resolved or not. If the parties acknowledge or agree that more is coming, doesn't that fit the language of the statute?
It does not, because it does matter, because what if the motion had never been brought? What if, and Justice Dallet made this point, what would happen if the motion for overtrial had never been brought, even though it was contemplated and discussed and put in the recitation portion of an order? If it's not before the court, that does matter, especially in post-judgment divorce cases. You frequently have multiple post-judgment motions that are brought. Somebody gets a new job, somebody loses a job, somebody wants to move out of state. You have all these issues in a divorce action, post-judgment, where a new issue arises and you have separate motion, separate argument, separate briefing, and a separate decision. Each one of those, very similar to a probate action where you have special proceedings, each one of those can be final and are final if they're substantive and deal with that issue. So it does matter that there has to be a place for litigants and courts to go to and know, is this final or not? And if it's not at the time of entry of a decision, we'll be adding a new category to appellate jurisdiction, which currently doesn't exist, and that is something in the future may someday be filed.
Counsel, I'm perplexed. That's a problem. I'm perplexed because you seem to be talking about if something is pending. Is that the same as the language of the statute that disposes of the entire matter in litigation as to one or more of the parties? Where do you get this language if something is pending?
Well,
probably in one of my decisions. I don't know. That just doesn't seem right, because there can be things pending that don't reflect the matter that's really in litigation. Motion filed sets forth here, I think, maybe three avenues of what's requested with regard to maintenance, including termination and change and modification. So where is this pending coming from?
Well, it comes from the fact that in order for there to be final order, it has to resolve of everything that's before the court.
Okay, if it has to resolve everything before the court, forget this over-trial stuff, you know, because as I see it, it wasn't yet, it was argued, but the motion, thank you very much, was not yet filed, you know. But what was pending before the court is number 6 in the order. The court said in number 6 in the order, and I'm paraphrasing, look, you're entitled to attorney's fees on the motion to compel, but I don't know what the amount is, so file with me the amount. And dates were given. I noted when I had it in front of me that those dates were before May 24th, you know, time to file and time to respond. So isn't that pending?
Sure, that was pending.
Okay, and so then why are you arguing it's final, or are you saying it's non-substantive? How can you get around it?
It falls within the Campbell and Leske and Laub exception, which says if there is a motion pending that deals with fee shifting or statutory basis, then the resolution of that should not affect finality. But for those exceptions, there might be a different analysis.
You in the brief indicated that overtrial is substantive. Is that the label that you also give to the attorney's fees for a motion to compel?
I don't. I know counsel did. There are substantive elements of every motion, that's certain. But this court has ruled in those cases that the determination of attorney fees, if it's fee shifting or if it's statutory based, is more ministerial and it's a matter of just filling in the amount. And therefore, I would not put those in the substantive category.
Are you done?
For now.
Okay. So I'm curious about your strategy here. It seems to me you could have had a bright line rule if you had said these overtrial fees fall under attorney's fees, they fall under the exception in Campbell. And I think Justice Anne Walsh Bradley is sort of bringing you to that point as well. Why not argue that?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, as we explained in our brief, we don't think that's necessarily ripe for this court. It was never addressed at the circuit court level. It wasn't addressed by the Court of Appeals. It's never been addressed by the Court of Appeals. It's never been addressed by this court. That this court, it would be prudent for this court to allow the circuit court or a Court of Appeals to address that so that this court would have the benefit of that. Having said that, if the court finds that the May 24th, 2023 order is final, then it never has to reach this issue. That's the second issue. Third, that even though when you have attorney fees, they fall within a continuum, a spectrum. On the one hand, you have the fee shifting, and on the other hand, you have the contractual. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you have attorney fees if it becomes an element of a cause of action, say damages, for like a bad faith action. And then overtrial falls somewhere in the middle. This court has never addressed that. No court has ever addressed this. We think it would be proper for the circuit court, Eighth Circuit Court, to decide that, and then a Court of Appeals before it gets to this court. Having said that, the case cited by David that talks about overtrial, the In Re Estate of Zhang case, refers to overtrial as a sanction. That being the case, it certainly falls closer to the exception in Leske and Laub
and that, but it's just we don't feel it's currently before the court, and we're not running from the fact that we feel it is substantive.
Attorney Lyons, are you asked, or were you done, Justice Kurofsky?
I was. I think that was Justice Rebecca Brown.
Rebecca, go ahead.
If I may, then.
Sure.
Justice Protase, what's next? Counsel, there's been a lot of argument in the briefing of the uncertainty that might be triggered by enhancing this rule or enforcing the rule if finality statements are not included or not thought of. But under the facts of this case, if your client had decided not to file that motion, wouldn't she have had every incentive to submit an amended proposed order to the court, including a finality statement, in order to trigger the time for appeal, because she was the prevailing party, right? So she has every incentive to ensure that the clock starts running as soon as it should start running. So I don't really see it as a situation in this case or in any other case where this issue is going to linger and we're just not going to know when a case is final, because one or the other party, whomever prevails, is going to have an incentive to ensure that an order with a finality statement is submitted, particularly if this court chooses to reinforce its holding in Wambold and demand, require, that courts include the finality statement.
Sure. Well, the time to the clock ticking, as Justice refers to, clicks regardless of the existence or lack of a finality statement, and this court has said that multiple times. It started to click on May 24, 2023, because it resolved of all matters pending before it. 100% was complete. The existence or non-existence of a finality statement doesn't trigger anything according to this court.
But what it does trigger is appellate court review when there is an ambiguity, and arguably there is an ambiguity because the court's order left open not just a possibility. It said Karen will file a separate motion, which you've conceded is substantive. And under those circumstances, Wambold says, absent explicit language, which I think you concede does not exist in the order, that the document is intended to be the final order or final judgment for purposes of appeal, appellate courts should liberally construe ambiguities to preserve the right of appeal. I don't see how the Court of Appeals applied that rule from Wambold in this instance, where it seems pretty clear that the order is ambiguous in the absence of the explicit language on finality.
Well, we would take issue with the fact that the order is ambiguous. We do not believe that it is because of that phrase that's in there, that Karen will file a motion, is simply a recitation. It is not an order by the circuit court. It would need to be, which is why David is pushing that so hard. It would need to be an actual order by the circuit court that Karen will file, not may file, will file a motion for overtrial. And as I stated earlier, there is no authority that would allow a circuit court to do that.
Are you suggesting that this court should do nothing to add teeth? Although I don't know what other teeth could be added to the language in Wambold, which is pretty clear. It is a command from this court that the statement is required. If we do nothing in this case, don't you think that would send a signal to counsel and maybe circuit courts that it is an important to include the statement, notwithstanding Wambold's explicit instructions?
And now may be a good time to get to the second issue, which is the whole Wambold finality issue, and that is this court has been very well-meaning when it comes to this issue of finality, and by putting the statement in there. Unfortunately, it hasn't had the result that it has wanted.
And that's what I was going to ask you, counsel. Are you asking us to eliminate the Wambold rule? Is that what you're arguing for?
I am, and I'll explain to the court why. It was well intended for this court to do what it did, and it tried several times to enforce and add more teeth to the decision. And now we have another suggestion to add boxes that you can check. You can check if it's final or if it's not, although now I heard this morning maybe not all orders need to have box checks. So then we're going to have that kind of an issue. Although it was well-meaning, what happened was this, is the court has ruled multiple times that the existence of that or the lack of it doesn't affect whether it's final or not. And one of the cases talked about how the Wambolt rule was supposed to protect the unwary. I think it's had the opposite effect. Sophisticated litigator, appellate practitioners, they know to look at the final order and look and see whether or not they believe it is final. And if they have any doubt, they can file a protective appeal and then add another appeal. And today you don't need to consolidate. It just gets added. And it's a very simple routine. You fill out a two-page document and you submit them. It's the unsophisticated appellate practitioner and the pro se litigant who's been listening to the circuit court give other orders. And that circuit court then says, this is not a final order, or leaves it blank and thinks, I'm safe, I don't have to appeal now because there's no order on here that says it's a final order. And then 91 days later, lo and behold, that less sophisticated appellate practitioner or pro se litigant is out of luck.
Go ahead, counsel.
At the end of the day, no matter what labels or boxes or whatever you put on it, it always comes back to the exact same analysis. Was it final at the time of entry, looking at the document itself? What did it completely and 100% take care of all the issues that were raised in the post-judgment motion? And in this case, it did.
Is it an efficient use of judicial resources to basically incent litigants to file multiple appeals in matters like this where there are multiple orders coming from the circuit court? And my second question is, isn't the circuit court, and with the aid or with bringing motions as the case may be, isn't it better for the circuit court and counsel to determine whether the order is final rather than letting it get to the appellate courts where we weren't there, right? We have to read the transcripts and try to figure out what was going on. But the circuit court is there through every step of the proceedings. It strikes me that we're in a lesser position to determine that. And if you will, we're kind of making this retrospective review of, oh, yeah, this is final or this isn't final, when the parties and the circuit court might have had really a different idea. And I guess I have a third question. This is really unfair to you, isn't it, counsel?
Go ahead. Fine.
What about the check-the-box form? I mean, that would be an easy way of doing it, right? Nobody can overlook it if there's a box that needs to be checked.
Oh, that last part, I guess, I would disagree with. I think there will be many times that neither box would be checked, because maybe it would be one of those orders, as counsel said, that maybe doesn't need a box checked. Well, what if it does? And what if both boxes are checked? Because that would happen. And there would be many times like that. That's what's happening now, is that despite all the well intentions, and what happens if even the circuit court and both litigants say it's a final order and they go up on appeal and the court of appeal says, no, it's not. It's not final, or the opposite. Everybody down below believes that it is not final, and on 91st day, eventually it becomes final, or it is final, and they're deprived of subject matter jurisdiction, even though they were all well-intended. And to get to the very first question that Justice asked me, it is a balance. On the one hand, it is good to notify and have all the litigants all be on the same page and try to take care of this at the trial court level. But as this court recognized in Admiral Insurance, there's a public policy aspect to this as well that's countervailing to that, which is the efficient, and I'm quoting, the efficient administration of justice is frustrated where, oh, now I'm quoting, quote, the time for appeal of judgments and orders that explicitly dispose of the entire matter in litigation would be indefinitely extended. And this goes back to Justice Dallet's original comment. What happens in this case if Karen doesn't file a motion for overtrial? And then we hear, well, maybe counsel would have made a phone call or submitted something. What if we got different counsel? What if the circuit court still would have said it's not final?
So I have a question.
Yes.
Let's say that this appeal had been filed, and then later the motion for overtrial came. What you're saying is that could be made to the court. The court could address that motion separately. And if an appeal came of that all a party has to do is fill out a two-page form and it gets added to the appeal.
Well, yes. Well, the notice of appeal. So you fill out the notice of appeal, and you'd have the first appeal. And nowadays, you don't have...
Right. So you don't have to file a motion to consolidate.
You do not.
Saying.
Not anymore.
Okay.
In the old days...
So then when you talk about multiple appeals, because that was one of the points made, is that we're going to have all these times that you have to have all these motions to appeal, what you're saying is no. That's not the reality.
Not anymore. Okay. In the old... I'm old. But in the old days, you had to file motions for consolidation, and maybe they'd get granted, maybe they wouldn't, and they're not anymore. You file the one appeal, and you file another notice of appeal, and they both get connected.
How do you define the language in the statute, entire matter in litigation?
Yeah. The entire...
did I quote it right? The entire matter?
I believe so. I think that refers to the entire matter... As this court has, I'll say it a little bit better. It addresses at the time that the order was entered. If at that point there's nothing before the circuit court, which was the case here.
So let me give you an alternative, and I think I know your answer then. Is the entire matter in litigation framed by what the motion says? You know, what's the matter? Maintenance, modify, terminate. Is that the matter in litigation? Is that what the statute means? Just a minute. An entire matter in litigation. Or does it mean anything that comes up outside of the framed issues that the court is entertaining and that is pending at the time of the final order, or at the time of the order. What is it? How do you define entire matter, entire?
The entire matter in litigation always starts in a post-judgment setting like this. It always starts with a motion. And then so you first look at whether or not that motion was completely and fully resolved. If along the way other substantive issues develop, and they could then be part of that litigation.
So but, that's part of the entire matter in litigation.
Sure.
Not just framed by the pleading, it's the motion itself.
Sure.
Is that what you think? Huh?
In Admiral Insurance, for example, you had the original complaint and then you had a counterclaim. And counsel referenced that. And that's absolutely right. That was still pending. That was pending at the time that the summary judgment motion was granted.
You know, if we're talking about pre-judgment, you've got those legal documents that frame the issues.
Sure.
Claim, counterclaim, cross-claim, etc. But in this context, you have, could have a motion and a cross-motion or two motions filed, which would frame the matters in litigation, arguably. But your interpretation is much broader, much broader. Contempt, let's say contempt comes up during litigation.
Contempt's a special proceeding, and therefore it kind of has its own special rules.
No. Oh, I don't mean it quite like that. I mean, we've been clear. I'm sorry. We've been clear that the distinction between special proceeding and judgment are one and the same with regard to this issue. There's no distinction between the two.
Sure. I guess what I see my time is up.
You may finish.
Okay. What I was attempting to say is that if it's coming up in the motion that's currently pending, other substantive motions, contempt could be one of them, could also be at the exact same time. What matters then is when the order comes down, did it deal with everything substantive that was in front of it? Because otherwise, the circuit court can't resolve things that haven't yet been filed.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. O'Neill, rebuttal?
It's 808075, isn't it? I have another question, though. Is it Wambolt or Wambolt?
I, in my mind, have said Wambolt now for 8 months, so okay. I'm sticking with Wambolt. But I don't know Mr. or Mrs. Wambolt, so I have
no
idea.
It's okay. We're used to having some good debates.
I was going to start, Your Honor, that... Yes, the first statute that talks about the trial court's jurisdiction after an appeal is filed is 808.07, allowing relief pending appeal. And one of the subsections allows the court during the pendency of an appeal to hear and determine motion filed under 806.07. So I was half right,
yeah.
But 808.07 is what
I'm going to give you full credit. Thank you.
Also, I wanted to pick up on substantive. Footnote 10 in WAMBOLT says the following. Footnote 10, and I'm going to give you a moment to pull that up if you can.
Got it.
It says, our decision here moves away from the language in Harder that focuses on whether a document whether a document has disposed of all of these, quote, substantive issues, end quote, in litigation. It's certainly the case where substantive issues remain, a document dismissing or judging only part of the action. Now it goes to the action, you know, the claim, the cross-claim, et cetera. Cannot conclude a final order or judgment. It continues, rather than saying whether it disposes of all of the substantive issues, now I conclude with the language, the question is whether it disposes of the entire matter in litigation as to one or more parties. So what do you make of that?
What I make of it is the court was trying to make this more objective, less subjective, in the sense that prior to Harder coming down in the Red Owl days and the other cases, there was an element where the court would look to what the circuit court's stated intent was. And this footnote I read is saying we're trying to move away from that.
Well,
and,
indeed, there's another footnote or someplace that says we are moving away from intent. But this also says moving, we don't use substantive. That's not our focus. It's whether all the matters in the action, you know, or proceeding have been.
Well, this idea of substantive litigation is embedded in this footnote and saying where substantive issues do remain, a document dismissing only a part of the action can't be final. Can't be final. And so the court is in this footnote saying there is some consideration of whether it is substantive. And I view this substantive versus non-substantive issue to be a matter like Obertrial where you have to actually look at the record, make a determination, take argument from the parties, and make a determination from first principles about whether something existed or doesn't exist, versus assessing costs, versus doing technical, mechanical things. And so that's where I see this footnote and what it means. And I don't think the court was backing off from what it said before in Wambolt in paragraph 27 of the decision, where it said there's two issues when you're looking at finality. The first is, as a matter of law, substantive law, what it says is the document final as a matter of substantive law insofar as it disposes of the entire matter in litigation? That was consideration one. Consideration two is whether it was the last document in litigation, which is to say the circuit court did not contemplate a subsequent document from which an appeal could be taken.
Yeah. And that quotes, as I recall, that quotes, of course, the Harder decision.
Yes.
But then, you know, that footnote says, but red flag on, or at least a yellow flag on Harder, our decision here moves away from the language in Harder. Yeah.
I agree. That footnote and the prior paragraph 27, one could read as in tension with each other. But I think the answer to that is what the court said after it created the rule saying, hey, trial courts, include a statement that is final for purposes of appeal. And if you don't, any ambiguity has to be liberally construed in support of the right to appeal. And that is exactly where this case, if the court finds that there is any reading of that May 24th order, that it actually disposes of all matters in litigation between the two parties, because the Obertrial motion had not yet been filed, was 9 days in the future, then I think it's ambiguous.
I am an anti-floodgate person. Floodgates are there
like
to
the
keep
flood
the flood away.
The
I mean, I am a pro-floodgate person.
Yeah, okay. There you go.
I'm anti-floods.
Okay.
gosh, I almost sunk my ship here, didn't I? I don't want everyone running and saying, oh, there's ambiguity, and so construe it liberally. That's a flood.
And, Your Honor, this is exactly why the light bulb went off when I was working on this, that why can't Womble be even a little more exacting, and it's not much more, but requiring a court on any order following a dispositive motion or a trial to say this is a final order for purposes of appeal or this is not a final order. It's a low burden, it prevents the floodgates, it helps keep just one appeal, and it makes it clearer and easier for the parties to effectively protect the right to appeal.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes oral arguments in the case of Moreway versus Moreway. The court will reconvene at 11:30 for a bar admission ceremony, and Justice Protasiewicz will meet with Waupun High School at 12:30. Again, thank you for joining us today for oral arguments. I hope you enjoy your visit at the Capitol. Okay.